You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Welcome to the show. I'm excited to introduce my guest this week, Rich Little, the legendary impressionist. He's been in show business for decades and has not only done great impressions of great people, but he's met and gotten to know them too. And he's written a book about it. It's called Little by Little, People I've Known and Been. Rich Little, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you.
The art of the impressionist, it's really kind of going away today. I mean, there are those people on Saturday Night Live, but they don't really try for the uncanny impersonation so much as satire. Do you think that's because today's stars are not as larger than life as they were in the golden age of Hollywood? I mean, can you do Brad Pitt or Tom Hanks or people like that?
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. You know, I mean, Saturday Night Live has its moments, but I think the humor is pretty thin at times. But, you know, they're doing a lot on Donald Trump right now. Alec Baldwin is doing Donald Trump quite well, actually. He looks like him.
He looks like him, but he wouldn't fool
voice,
you.
But,
yeah. I mean, some of yours...
It's a little cruel. You've got to know how far you should go, you know. Between just being, funny and being cruel, and you gotta know how far you can go there. And I guess he's gone over the line a few times, and Donald isn't too happy about it. But that's the nature of being a politician. You have to take the shots, you know.
But he doesn't, he wouldn't fool you on the telephone. You know, he doesn't really get like a uncanny. Some of yours over the years, you know, when you do Jimmy Stewart or Jack Benny, you could hardly tell that it's not a tape of them. I don't think you could say that about Alec Baldwin's Donald Trump.
It's interesting. He's an actor, and now he's become an impersonator. Interesting. Not too many people have done that.
You did it the other way. You were first an impersonator and then an actor, yeah?
And then became an actor. Well, actually, I was an actor first because I, back in Ottawa, Canada, I'm a Canadian, I did a lot of little theater plays when I was younger, and a lot of dramatic things, you know, like Bus Stop and, Desperate Hours and things like that. But then I got into comedy because I became an impersonator. But I didn't really think of becoming a comedian, really. I just wanted to do voices. And, of course, you have to be funny. And so that was quite a surprise to me. But I was lucky in the early days when I did a lot of variety shows to have good writers and people that wrote me some great material. And that helped an awful lot, you know.
Writers who would say, okay, what can we say that would make Humphrey Bogart funny or whatever?
Yeah, well, you know, they write lines for you, and on most of the variety shows you did, there would be a script, and you could change it, you could take things out, or write some of your own things in if they were agreeable. I mean, I did that a lot on the Dean Martin roast. I used a lot of my material and a lot of theirs, and it was a combination of both, really.
Those were funny, and you did quite a few of them. You were practically always on those, weren't you?
I did 24. I think I was on more times than anybody else. And I think the reason was if I could imitate four or five people sitting on the dais, that was when they booked me on the show because, it's great when you're doing an impression and you can cut to the real person for their reaction. That's always a great hook, you know, and it happened with me with Ed Sullivan and many people. Just show me with the real person, you know?
Yeah, yeah, and you can always tell if they're a good sport or not, if they're laughing.
Well, yeah, exactly, you know, and Ed Sullivan used to fake it because I don't think he ever liked it.
Well, you wrote in your book also that you thought that... that Paul Lynde wasn't happy with your impression of him.
No, Paul Lynde was not happy with my impression at all. He, maybe I exaggerated him too much, but, they had always cut to Paul when I would do him on a roast or do him on Hollywood Squares, and he'd always say, "How's he doing? Who's that? Oh, that's pathetic. Get a day job. Oh, that's disgusting." you know, but which was kind of funny, actually, until I finally realized that he really doesn't like it, and we were not that friendly, you know, but he was funny on Hollywood Squares. I have to give him that. He kept that show alive for many, many years.
Oh, he did that for 10 years or something, didn't he?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He didn't like it. You know, he wanted to be a leading actor, but he was hardly the type. But, you know, he was great on Hollywood Squares, but he really would rather not have done it. And there were nights when we had to coax him to get up there in the square, and sometimes he was so bombed we had to tie him into the seat.
A lot of drinking. A lot of drinking went on.
Well, yeah, he had a drinking problem. And but you know, it's funny. You could watch those shows today and you'd never know it.
Yeah.
Because he still was funny, whether he was drunk or sober. But he had a lot of problems, poor Paul. He really did.
Yeah.
It was a shame because everybody loved him, you know.
It was a different era.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You know, I know there's like a brotherhood of magicians, and they hang out at the Magic Castle and they show each other. Was there like a brotherhood of impressionists? Did you and David Fry and Frank Gorshin hang out and talk like Nixon and
Cooper?
No,
not really. No. The only time we ever did was when we did a show called Copycats,
yeah,
which was done in England in the 70s. And we hung out, you know, when we did that show, but we didn't hang out together. Well, that's not entirely true. I was friendly with Fred Trevelino,
mm-hmm,
who passed away a few years ago. He was a very nice man and a great impersonator. And there's one in Vegas called Gordy Brown, and he's from Ottawa, my hometown, and we're very, very close. But the others, well, George Kirby, you know.
Oh, yeah.
He did impressions, you know, back in the 70s. He helped me a lot, and we were very friendly. You know, he was great. He was very, very helpful.
Were you critical of other impersonators when you, you know, Von Meter or, you know, whatever, when you heard them?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, Von Meter did the First Family Rise Again and did Kennedy.
Right.
And did it so well that I had to imitate Von Meter to get a reaction. Nobody particularly liked my impression because Von Meter was so associated with Kennedy.
Yeah.
And
but you were going for more authenticity, and he was going for the more
sometimes,
satirical.
Sometimes, you know, the impersonator can sound more like the person they're doing than the person themselves. I remember Will Jordan, who did Ed Sullivan.
Right, he made a whole career out of it.
He sounded more like Ed than Ed did. I mean, it was funny. We had him on Copycats, Ed Sullivan, and he couldn't do himself, and he had to ask Will how to do Ed Sullivan. kind of funny when you think of it.
You got to meet so many, not only of your heroes, but so many of my heroes. I'm so jealous of all those people that you... I just watched you on the Judy Garland show, because you mentioned it in your book. And what a wonderful moment,
yeah,
that is. Judy's sitting there demanding that you do all these characters, and you do them all perfectly.
Well, thank you. Well, she'd never... she'd never seen me before we taped the show. I mean, she was never at rehearsal. So the reaction I got on the show was Judy's reaction for the very first time. And actually, it added to my routine because it's quite genuine. I mean, she is reacting because she never was at rehearsal. And it paid off, actually.
Well, now, you know, you must have been, I mean, I realize you've met so many famous people, but that was pretty early in your career. That you must have been a little starstruck when Judy Garland walked in. You go, oh, my God, that's actually Judy Garland.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, of course I was.
Yeah.
Yes, of course I was. She's a big star, and I was just a kid from Canada, you know. I didn't know all the turmoil that was going on at the moment, you know, when we taped that show back,
yeah,
in 64. You know, Judy was having a lot of problems, but I wasn't aware of all that. I just thought there were technical delays, and I didn't know that they couldn't get her out of the dressing room, and she was, you know, drinking too much and everything. I didn't figure that out until later.
She seems awfully relaxed.
I didn't finish shooting that show until about 3 or 4 in the morning.
Wow. She seems so relaxed and natural sitting there with you.
Oh, yeah. She was very nice to me. Extremely nice to me. And when I did my impression of James Mason, that's the one that really got her attention.
Yeah.
And it's the best one, I think, on the tape. Because she had worked with him on A Star Is Born, and they were very close.
You know, I've been watching a lot of your clips now, and I can't remember which one was which, but I think I saw you do Fred McMurray on that Judy Garland thing.
Fred McMurray, yeah, that's right. Fred McMurray had a voice like this, very kind of husky, and, you know, I haven't done him in years.
And people don't know him anymore.
He used to get a kick out of it. He used to say to me, Rich, I think you sound more like me than I do. You should do my movies.
I wish you had. No, he was a fine actor. I enjoyed him a lot. And I guess, you know, today, if you did Fred McMurray, the people would look at you like, don't know who Fred McMurray is.
Well, older people would.
Yeah.
People that grew up in that era would.
Like
you
me.
Know, you remember him from all those Walt Disney movies he made, and Double Indemnity, which was his best movie.
What a great picture that is, yeah.
Yeah, that's a great movie. And that's when I started to imitate him, when I watched him in Double Indemnity. And, you know, I had a great career. And we were friendly, actually. I knew him fairly well. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, when you say, you know, you haven't done it for years, do you ever forget how to do it? Do you ever think, how do I do Fred McMurray? I can't.
No, not really. I think once you get a voice down, it pretty well stays with you, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to, you have to work at it a little bit to get it back to what it was before, but it comes back. You know, it's like skating. Once you can skate for life, you know.
Yeah. Well, let's go skating. You ever notice the similarities between certain people's voices? Like, tell me if I'm wrong, but I always noticed that Gene Kelly and John Garfield have almost the exact same voice.
Gene Kelly and John Garfield?
Yeah.
Really? That's interesting.
You have to go back and listen to that. What about
Gene Kelly had that kind of a high voice like this, you know, when he talked. And let me think. Who was the other one?
John Garfield.
John Garfield. Yeah. Sure. I know exactly what you mean. I flipped a coin and...
Yeah, that's a little bit the same. And I know you do a great Anthony Newley, and I've always noticed that Anthony Newley and David Bowie sound almost identical.
That's interesting.
I think David Bowie did it on purpose, and he heard Anthony Newley, and you know when he says ground control to Major Tom, it's almost in the voice of Anthony Newley.
Well, I loved Anthony Newley. God, yeah. What a talented man he was.
Did you get to know him also?
Oh, I got to know him. We worked together a lot, and I used to just absolutely, I was memorized by him because, not too people remember him, wrote a lot of songs, and but he was a terrific singer and a good actor, too. He's in a lot of movies, but if you do remember him, you wouldn't forget him because he was very dramatic and had that kind of Cockney accent, you know, and I thought he was one of the greats.
All right, I love him also. And of course, when you do it as impression, you can also sing those beautiful songs, yeah?
Yeah.
Can you do just a little taste, if you don't mind?
Of Anthony Newley?
Yeah, can you do it?
Let's see, what would you do? So many songs, aren't there?
Who can I turn to?
Who can I turn to? My heart wants to now, and so I must go where destiny leads me.
I feel like I'm either talking to Anthony Newley or David Bowie on the phone now.
Well, he didn't have that accent when he talked as much as when he sang.
Huh.
Usually the opposite.
Yes.
You know, people that have an accent when they sing, they lose it, but... you know, he sang with that Cockney accent, and actually, it made him more dramatic, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, I suppose there's a lot of people listening now who don't even remember him. But,
well, Who cares?
It's interesting you brought him up because he's one of my favorite entertainers of all time.
Yeah, one of mine, too. I think, you know, those plays, Roar the Grease Paint and Stop the World, are fantastic plays and many of his films. I just loved him and his records, and I think he was fantastic.
Yeah. Well, great.
Thank you for bringing him back for us there.
For a few minutes, yeah.
I mean, of course, I love Bing Crosby, too. And Bing, I think Bing was, you know, the greatest entertainers of all time. And I was watching
there. Bing, you know, Bing, people don't realize that Bing sold over 500 million records, you know.
And, isn't that incredible?
Nobody can top that. And still has the biggest seller of all time, White Christmas. And a lot of people think that Bing was, you know, a man who was cold and beat his children and all that, and it was all rubbish because he was one of the nicest people I've ever known. He was a sweetheart, and I think his son Gary wrote that book on him because he needed the money, and he was an alcoholic, and said a lot of very unkind things about Bing that the other brothers said weren't true. So he got a bum rap, you know, Bing did, because Bing was very, very nice man. Very.
Well, it must have been just a dream to sit there with him and duet with him like you did.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, show you what kind of a guy he was when we did a medley together on my show. And I was nervous as hell. And I kept making mistakes. And, I'm not really a singer. And, and Bing was aware of that, and I kept apologizing. And then on the next take, Bing made a mistake on purpose to make me look better.
That was nice of him.
Yeah, that's the mark of a really nice guy, you know. When you're having a problem, they have a problem too, and they kind of fake it. But he was very, very, very nice to me. I absolutely adored Bing.
Bing, over the years, you've made so many great films.
Well, truthfully, Rich, I was kind of lucky. You know, I had so many great partners, Fred Astaire, Frank Sinatra, Gartha Lamour, and that other fella. Oh, what's it? The guy with the nose.
There he is, the Elton John of the Geritol set.
But some great duets have come out of some of those movies.
Yeah, so what the boy's trying to say here is that he'd like to wrap his tonsils around some of those beautiful tunes out of Tinseltown. You know, a medley of the merry music that I performed with so many great performers in the past.
Boy, I wish I'd have said that.
You have, many times.
Well, I think what the old groaner is trying to say here is maestro, a little, little teammate music in the key of O.J.
In us you see a couple of song and dance men.
Go, Fred.
I'm the song, I'm the dance. For laughter, joy, and happiness, we're advanced men. With a song and the dance. I sing for my supper, I dance for my lunch, and I croon when the landlord comes around. For miles and miles, the women and children pass out cold. When my voice hits the air, when my feet hit the ground. God vision,
there's a sign upon my door.
God vision,
I ain't working anymore. There's my home out in the sun,
yeah,
where I left her who I've done. I said, who ain't no fun?
He ain't got no ambition. Gone fishing.
True love, and on and on.
Tanya, but I don't do Grace Kelly.
Do Gene Kelly. It's the same key.
Oh, okay. But to give to me and to give to you love forever true.
Hey, Gene is higher.
It's in the stars. Next July we collide with Mars.
Well, did you ever? What a swell party this is.
Have you heard that poor dear Blanche, she got run down by an avalanche?
Well, did you ever?
What a marvelous, fabulous, elegant, swell-again party this is.
Let's meet on the road to Morocco. Instead of the tunnel, the
love. 12 kids, a little late for the tunnel, love pops.
The desert night, the Arab tents, the harem atmosphere.
But I want to tell you,
it's the best attraction Coney Island has this year.
Tell the gang so they won't hang around.
Like Webster's Dictionary, we're Morocco. Round the bend, you'll see a sign. Dreamer's Highway. Happiness is down the line. Going my way. The smiles you gather will look well on you.
Ooh, Danny.
Oh, I hope you're going my way to ba-ba-boo. Or would you rather be a fish? A fish won't do anything but swim in a brook. Can't write his name or read a book. To fool the people, that's his only thought. Though he's slippery, he still gets caught. But then if that sort of life is what you wish, you might grow up to be a fish.
And all the monkeys aren't in the zoo. Every day you meet quite a few. So you see, it's all up to you. You can be better than you are. You could be swinging on a star.
That was Bing Crosby singing with my guest, Rich Little.
He seemed to enjoy your impression of him a lot.
Yeah, yeah, he did. He got quite a kick out of it, you know, and I did a lot of things with him down through the years. And he was totally different than Sinatra, you know. Frank was a different personality entirely than Bing was. And a lot of singers, of course, imitated Bing Crosby in the early days. But Frank was a guy had a style of his own, and I think Bing really admired Frank, and Frank, of course, idolized Bing. So they got along great together.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. We're chatting with impressionist Rich Little, and he's just written a book called Little by Little, People I've Known and Been.
Now, which is, you know, when you're going to put a record on, which would be more your taste, Sinatra or Crosby?
Oh, boy, that's tough. I'm probably Frank, because I just love his music, and I play it all the time.
Yeah.
And, Frank, his interpretation of a song is just incredible. I mean, you felt when you listened to a Frank Sinatra record that he was telling you a story, and he was really involved in the words and what they meant. And his phrasing was unbelievable. You know, he's got to be one of the greats. I think of Frank, really, if you look at his career, I think his music is where he really shines. Because, you know, he made a couple of good movies, but not that many. But his records are pretty good.
Yeah, I think making records, of all the things that he did, you know, performing live movies.
Yeah, he took that the most seriously.
Making
yeah.
records. I did have
a lot of movies he didn't take seriously at all, you know, one take and that.
Walked through them, yeah. I did have the opportunity I did have the opportunity to see him live, but I never saw Crosby live, which would have been great.
Yeah, we did a few shows together, Bing and I.
Yeah.
But and Frank, too. I worked with Frank a lot, too. So I was very lucky to have worked with those two giants, you know.
Yeah, and they were pretty different personalities, I would think.
Oh, yeah, entirely different personalities.
Bing, kind of easygoing. Frank, not so much.
Well, Frank was a man of moods, you know. If he's in a good mood, he was terrific, but if he's in a bad mood, stay away. But when he was in a good mood, though, he was a very charming man and very polite and nice to people and, you know, and cooperative. And but then he could turn, you know, and suddenly he was just a tyrant, you know.
There could be a horse's head.
I didn't see much of that, so I was lucky. I didn't see the bad side of Frank too much.
Well, now I've heard you do Frank singing. Did you do his speaking voice also?
Well, a little bit, you know. Frank, certain words Frank did, you know, like marvelous, marvelous, baby, absolutely marvelous, Richie, baby. You know, he, you know, a little bit of that Hoboken sound was in his voice from time to time, you know.
Yeah.
Never really lost it entirely, but. If he liked you, he would call you. He wouldn't call anybody Bob. It would be Bobby. It would be Richie or Jimmy. You know.
Yeah.
And you could tell if he liked you, he put an IE at the end of your name.
In addition to doing people's voices, can you do any dialect?
No, not really. No, I do. You know, I can do English.
Yeah.
Because I spent a lot of time in England, so. English accent never bothered me, but I don't speak any other languages.
But is it a different thing? I mean, when you're if you're a dialect coach, they'll teach you how to place your tongue in a certain place to get a sound. So when you're doing an impression, impersonation, I guess is the word you prefer. You know, how do you do it? What is the physical act of doing it?
Well, you just have to sort of pretend you're that person for the time you're doing it. You to get in their skin, and you have to listen to them a lot and see if you can pick up on their mannerisms. I mean, sometimes I get so into doing Johnny Carson that I really feel I am Johnny Carson. When I'm on stage, and then when I would go off stage and go to my dressing room, I would find myself writing out an alimony check.
I don't believe that, but it's a good line.
So I do Dean Martin so well they'd have to carry me back to the dressing room.
Well, it's good stuff. It's funny stuff. When you're working on an impression, how do you have a tape and you play the tape back, take your own voice back to yourself to listen to it?
Yeah. I put it on tape and then play it over 100 times. And I have to hear it in my head so before I do it, actually. It's kind of a strange thing, but I have to hear it. You know, a lot of people don't know what they sound like. And, you know, You can record them and then play it back, and they'd say, that doesn't sound like me, does it? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that's you. So most people don't hear it, but I have the ability, which is a blessing, to be able to hear it while I'm doing it. So I'm my worst critic because I can in the middle of doing an impression, say to myself, oh, that's not very good, or I could improve that, or, you know, I got to relax more, or I'm not concentrating enough, so I'm my worst critic, really.
Well, Rich Little, when you were a little boy and you first just sort of discovered this gift, were you, you know, sitting in the movie theater watching John Barrymore and thought, you know, I can sound. How did it happen that you found this talent?
Imitating teachers is really how it started.
Ah.
Yeah. Well,
must have got some laughs from the other kids.
And, it's one thing to be able to imitate the teacher, but to answer them in their voice and give the wrong answer, it didn't go over too well with the teachers, but the kids loved it. You know?
Yeah.
I should have got their signatures down, actually. Would have got better marks, but I imitated most of my teachers, and I would answer them in class in their voice, and finally they got wise to it, and they didn't ask me anything, and that was fine, too. I didn't mind that.
You know. a lot of the... Sometimes I can see you doing an impression... impersonation that you can tell who you're doing before you open your mouth. It's really, you know, when you do your George Burns or whatever, there's so much of it is the mannerisms or your
person. if you can do it physically like George or Jack Benny or Johnny Carson, it helps. Yeah. You know, if you look a little like them and have the mannerisms down, but very hard to look like Orson Welles, you know, or Raymond Burr.
Well, you've got to talk to me about this amazing thing that happened with you and Orson Welles. You know, people may know about this wonderful film that never got released. I think it's wonderful. I think it would probably be great, The Other Side of the Wind. But you're actually in
The Other Side of the Wind, yeah.
You're actually in it. You're actually in the picture.
Well, I don't think I'm in it now. If it ever came out now, I don't think I'd be in it because I worked on it for about 5 weeks, but... never finished my part, and then Peter Bogdanovich took over my part and shot all my scenes again.
Oh.
So I think if it was put together, I don't know whether it ever will be or not, but if it was put together, I don't think I'd be in it. But I did spend 5 weeks working on it, and working with Orson was a terrific experience. I mean, it was just a fantastic time with he and John Huston and a lot of other great actors that I admired, you know, like Edmund O'Brien and, Susan Strasberg and just a lot of great people, you know.
Edmund O'Brien, he had a distinctive voice. Can you do him?
No.
Just thought I'd throw that out.
Not a big demand today for Edmund O'Brien.
Yeah. Let me do Lloyd Rowland
like
for
you. Somebody the other night saw my show and said to me after, "Wow, wife and I enjoyed your show, but you didn't do our favorite. We were disappointed." I said, "Who's that?" Van Johnson.
Yeah, you never do Van Johnson.
It isn't exactly on my list, you know. Van Johnson. I actually, that was kind of funny. How would you do Van Johnson? You know.
I don't know.
But they expected me to do it. You know, that's funny. I guess.
Yeah,
when you're like an actor, you know. Yeah.
I was very disappointed you didn't do Guy Kibbe when I was watching you. And
oh, Guy Kibbe, yes. Byron Folger. Or
yeah. Why didn't you do your Franklin Pangborn?
Oh, yes. That's the name of the past, isn't it?
I really enjoyed this book, Little by Little, Rich Little. But tell me, just a story, when you were sitting at a restaurant with John Huston and Orson Welles, and somebody came up to the table, and here they had two great, you know, Hollywood legends.
Yeah.
And they wanted your autograph.
And wanted my autograph, and ignored those two. That's a true story. And, then leaned over and a loud voice said in front of them, "Who's your fat friend?" meaning Orson, you know. And that's when John Huston said, "We don't know. We found the poor devil on the highway. We brought him in here for a cherry Coke and some fries. We're going to fatten him up and send him on his way." And Orson said, "Thank you, kind sir. Thank you, from the bottom of my heart." That's a true story.
That is great.
Yeah. "Who's your fat friend?" Can you imagine saying that about Orson?
Orson, well, I'm sure he took it very well.
I couldn't help but laugh. I mean, I was just gagging. I mean, that was so funny because, I mean, who am I next to those giants, you know? But she knew who I was, but she didn't have a clue who they were.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. We're chatting with impressionist Rich Little, and he's just written a book called Little by Little, People I've Known and Been. You know, I've heard you do Carol Channing, but what about other women? Are there any other women that you can impersonate?
I do Katharine Hepburn and Jean Stapleton and a couple of women. Not many. They'd have to be...
They have to have a low voice.
Have a very distinctive voice. Dr. Ruth, I used to do her. Do you remember her?
Sure, of course.
Dr. Ruth Westheimer, who had a very squeaky kind of voice. You know, sex is a lot like air. It's not important unless you don't get any.
Well, that's great.
She was quite a character. I don't know what happened to her. I haven't seen her in years. I wonder if she's still with us.
Give her a call.
Oh, yeah. I'll phone her up and say, hello. How come I haven't heard from you? Wasn't she a munchkin in The Wizard of Oz? Maybe.
She might have been. Oh, that's funny. I know you're performing tonight. Where are you exactly? You're in Las Vegas?
I'm at the Tropicana Hotel in Vegas. I've been there for over a year, so it's time I went home. But I'm enjoying it. I just do an hour show in a place called the Laugh Factory every night, five nights a week, not every night, but having a lot of fun and a lot of people. You know, you have to kind of be my age group because there are a lot of young people today have no idea who Frank Sinatra is, you know, or any of these people, even
Richard Nixon. They probably don't know who Nixon is anymore.
No, they don't know Nixon. No. Some of them don't even know Reagan, you know?
Yeah.
They seem to know Bill Clinton, though. I wonder why.
Do you still add things to your repertoire? Do you still work on impersonations of new people?
Yeah, I'm working on Donald Trump right now. I mean, I haven't perfected it or anything, but I'm working on it every day.
Yeah,
well, I have to get it in my head. And
do you have to spend? Coming. You have to say, okay, I'm going to sit down for 2 hours and work on Donald Trump. How does that work? How does that go?
We're going to build a wall. You know, kind of a raspy voice, but he punctuates words, and he repeats himself a lot too.
Yes,
when he talks, you know, to make a point. You know, sometimes he rambles, doesn't he?
Sometimes.
I think he's refreshing, but he's not the typical politician. I'll tell you that right now. He comes out with some things that a politician would not say. You know.
Well, I mean, when you think about how Gary Hart had a girl on his lap, and that was the end of his whole career, and, you know, Donald Trump had all those, you know, recorded comments, and it didn't seem to bother anybody.
No. Well, it's just like Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
With all the women that he was involved with, didn't seem to hurt him. He's still popular as hell, you know?
Yeah.
And, I don't know. Maybe the bad boy image is appealing to certain people. Well, maybe with Frank Sinatra, certainly did.
Sinatra didn't run.
They liked the fact that Frank was kind of involved with the mob and was the son of a difficult guy. But that's kind of appealed to a lot of people, you know.
I doubt if he could have been elected to public office, though.
Who, Frank?
Yeah.
I bet he could.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. I think he could. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, it'd be certainly a different administration, I'll tell you that. Yeah. Call the White House the summit, right?
Yeah. Now, you've been to the White House quite a few times.
Yes, I have. Yeah, I have. Mostly during Reagan's administration. I was very close to Reagan, and I was there a lot with Reagan, and he was terrific. Oh gosh, he was so great. He really thought like a comedian, though. He wanted to be funny, and so anytime you talk to him, he'd go for a joke. You know, I remember once I said to him, one of my favorite movies is Casablanca, and I was reading somewhere, Mr. President, that you were one of the first people considered to play the lead in Casablanca. Is that true? And he said, no, Rich, that's not true. I think they always had their mindset on Ingmar Bergman. That's just funny.
He had some good writers, too, I guess.
And I said, no, I was thinking more of the Humphrey Bogart part. He said, no, I turned it down. I was lucky because I did Bedtime for Bonzo instead. And it was a finished script. Which is funny, because Casablanca was never a finished script.
Famously unfinished.
When they shot Casablanca, they had no idea how it was going to end. It never should have been a huge success, really, if you read the history of Casablanca.
But if you watch it, it's such a beautiful movie.
Oh, if you watch it, you think it's just, oh, brilliantly written, which it is, but they kind of made it up as they went along.
I've heard that so many times, and yet I find it so hard to believe because each line in the film seems to move the film forward.
Exactly.
Can you do a little Humphrey Bogart just for me?
I have all the gin joints and all the towns and all the world, and I had to walk into this one. here's looking at you, kid.
Beautiful. I appreciate that. Well, I know you have to go, so I'm going to let you go, but I want to tell everybody one more time. This book is called Little by Little, People I've Known and Been. It's a marvelous, as Frank would say, marvelous book.
Well, if you know a little bit about show business, and obviously you do, then it would mean more than somebody who, you know, I mean, I'm sure there's people reading that book who don't know who Stuart Granger is, but... you know, or remember Hubert Humphrey, but there are people to do, so that's good, you know.
And Jack Benny.
Jack Benny. Well, oh, Rich, listen, when you do me, you put four fingers up to your face. I only use three. Because three is funnier than four. He was so funny, Jack. Three is funnier than four, really? Of course. Everybody knows that.
He's probably right, you know.
I don't know. No, I think he made that up. It's funny, though, isn't it?
It is.
I don't think three is funnier than four, do you?
Well, when Jack Benny says it is, it is.
Well, Jack Benny said it was. I guess it was, you know.
Now, I just thought of one thing I must ask you before I let you go. So, Jimmy Stewart. When you do Jimmy Stewart, do you always do the latter-day Jimmy Stewart? Can you do both Jimmy Stewarts? Can you do this sort of the Mr. Smith
Jimmy,
Goes to Washington?
You know, when Jimmy was younger, actually, he talked fast.
Yeah.
You know, and he made Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. If you listen to that movie today, or watch it, you'll see how fast Jimmy talks, you know. You want to do something about this country? Well, get up off the ground. Get up there with that lady on top of the Capitol dome and take a look at this country. He talked fast in those days. But then when he got older, of course, near the end, you had to kind of crank him, you know, get him going like an old Model T Ford, you know, and Jim would finally get up to speed. He once said to me, he said, Rich, Judge, I wish you were around in the 40s. You could have dubbed a lot of my movies. He said, I talk so slow, and I never realized I talk so slow. He said, one time I was halfway through making a film, and I found out they'd already finished the sequel.
Now, I noticed the way you did that, the way you lowered your voice when he got older. Those were two completely different impressions that you did there.
Well, I think Jimmy did that, you know, just like Ronald Reagan always used to say, well, that gave him a second or two to think. And with Jimmy, he had to kind of think about the words and just kind of stumbled a bit. It's kind of a stall tactic, really, you know. And... it's interesting. I mean, but Jimmy did get slower as he got older, but then don't we all, you know, for that matter?
Not you.
That's the one thing you lose when you get older is your energy.
Well, not you, apparently. You're still playing every night.
Yeah, I'm very blessed. Just keep going as long as I can.
Now, I don't know.
Rickles is still performing.
Yeah, that's right. And he's older than you. I mean, I don't know how old you are, Rich Little, but...
You're only as old as the girls you feel. You know?
That's Groucho's line, I think.
Is it? Could be. Sounds like a Groucho line. You're only as old as the girls you feel. That's why I feel pretty old. It is a Groucho line.
Well, Rich Little, it's been a real honor to speak with you. Thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for reading the book. And you can get it on Amazon.com if you're interested. I don't know whether it's in the bookstores or not. Should be, but you can get it on Amazon.com. And if you're in Vegas, come and see me at the Tropicana. I'll be there. ¶¶
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Rich Little. His book is called Little by Little, People I've Known and Been. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. We'll see you next time.